Welcome, everyone, to the Interpreter Foundation podcast. I'm Terry Hutchinson, one of your hosts, and my co-hosts are Mark Johnson and Kevin Christensen. Good evening, gentlemen.
Hey, good evening, Terry.
Good evening.
Our Come Follow Me topic tonight is insights into Doctrine and Covenants, sections 85 through 87. Now, the mission of Interpreter Foundation is to support the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through faithful scholarship. We make the latest and best scholarship available to you in podcasts, journal articles, books, seminars, films, and scripture roundtables. You can visit us at interpreterfoundation.org and just check it out. Just surf the website. You'll find some fascinating things. And if you like this podcast, please tell your friends about it. Give us a five-star rating. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, Libsyn, or other podcast apps. Now, because the Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the comments that we make are solely our responsibility. And if you disagree with them, then take it up with Mark.
Sure, send me an email.
That's right.
We'll go at it. We'll thumb wrestle until I win.
Exactly. So we want to thank you for being with us tonight. This is a new format for us. So we're going to jump right in to the lesson for August 4th through the 10th, which is Doctrine and Covenants 85 through 87. And the theme is Stand Ye in Holy Places. Now, in Doctrine and Covenants section 85, verses 1 and 2, the saints are specifically commanded to keep a history. In verse 1, it is the duty of the Lord's clerk whom he has appointed to keep a history and a general church record of all things that transpire in Zion, and of all those who consecrate properties and receive inheritances legally from the bishop, and also their manner of life, their faith and works, and also of the apostates who apostatize after receiving their inheritances. Now, that second verse refers to something else. But, you know, it's fascinating that we get to talk about this tonight, brothers, because in our sacrament meeting, we were talking, and we're recording this on the 19th of July, or 20th of July, I should say. In our sacrament meeting today, our primary president talked about how she was a young woman who was visiting the Liberty Jail after her high school graduation and discovered that one of the men in the Liberty Jail was one of her ancestors. She didn't really make the connection, but she saw that he had a name that was the same as hers. And so she said, maybe I'll do some family history work on it. And she did. And she found that he was the one who recorded and was the scribe for the revelations Joseph Smith received in the Liberty Jail. And he was her great, great, great grandfather. And somehow her grandfather, right in the middle between her and him, had decided to leave the church and married a woman who wasn't a member of the church. And she didn't talk about how her parents had, how her father in particular had kind of overcome that challenge to become active in the church and had raised her in the church, and it led her to serve a mission and raise a family. But that was a very interesting family history type of thing that inspires us. In the manual, there is a link to a video done by Family Search of a man who, as a teenager, was kind of having a rough time. His father was a rancher in the 1960s, and he was starting to make bad choices and get in trouble with the police. And his father didn't know what else to do. So finally, he gave him the journal of one of his grandfathers, and his grandfather's grandfather, who had also struggled as a young man, and essentially said, I broke a lot of Bronx, and I had to have the Bronx broken out of me. And that struck him. And he talked about how it influenced him to keep a journal, but how it also influenced him to realize that he could kind of overcome some of these challenges and things like that. So I realized that in my desk here where I'm podcasting, I have a couple of journals. One of them is from my grandfather, who served a mission in Tahiti, and he kept one of these line a days. So there's like three or four lines every day, and he did that for the 3.5 years of his mission. So if we go to that, just taking random, like today, July 19th, July 20th of 1925, so exactly 100 years ago today, after breakfast, I started working in the post office. So he was assigned to be in the mission office in Papeete at that time. At 11:30 to 12:30, we had an eclipse of the sun, about two-thirds of which was covered. He took a French lesson and wrote to Elmer. On the same day in 1926, 99 years ago today, we continued work on the paper and got it all set up. I put in some time studying and wrote a little on some letters. And then in pencil, he says, Pareja and Tanico confessed to living in adultery. I don't know who those people are, but that was it.
Hope they turn it around.
I hope so too, but it's just, it's one of those things. And then his grandfather served a mission in, or maybe it was, I think it was his father in 1884, served a mission to Denmark. And he didn't have an entry for this day, but on the 12th of July, it says he went to visit something, I can't read it very well, with Brother A.H. Lund, and the brethren on the office was administered to and comforted, shared in Copenhagen 3 days, had a pleasant time, and went back feeling much better. Arrived in Harlan, or wherever he was, Harhouse, I should say, at 4 a.m. So just some fascinating things. It made me think of my mission journal, which somehow has disappeared. I might discover it someday, but that's a long time ago. Anyway, just a very interesting day for me in terms of journals and in terms of those messages. Kevin, you had something to say?
No, I just, it is very interesting. I mean, I'm thinking around here, I've got like, I got family histories from some of my grandparents and some stuff from my parents and the various places in the house. I've got bundles of letters and things. And I haven't done much. I mean, I've occasionally done journals for various reasons, but usually I think in terms of family emails where I've written up stuff and sent it out to everybody. And you know, my mother was real good at saving those and boxing them and putting them back. So I've got letters from my mission and things from various times like that. But I think just in terms of what they're talking about, having the church history here, it's, I mean, they people doing the best they could at the time and that adding up. And the thing that I think about nowadays is the Joseph Smith Papers Project is such an extraordinary thing. You know, when people, you know, used to say, well, you know, there's always some controversial bit. Well, somebody will say, well, how come nobody told me this or something? Now it's all there. You know, you've got the whole Joseph Smith Papers Project and it's all there. And it's something that helps you see. And it's, you know, just this kind of thing. There's accounts of people that did well in the church, people that had temporary problems, people that had permanent problems. And it just gives us a perspective on things. That's important. You can just see the consequences of choices. And that's something that especially young people sometimes have a hard time thinking through. But I don't remember if I've told this story here, that there's one of the family stories is when in 1941, my father was joined the army because of his draft number. Nobody'd hire him because they figured he's going to get drafted. So he figured he might as well join. So he joins up while he's in the army. And my mom and dad weren't married yet, but my grandmother goes to my mother and says, I very strongly feel like you should marry Wally. And mom thought about it and then proposed to dad. And dad said, okay, we'll get married. And then, but because he decided that he was going to get married, even though it was all, you know, there's so much uncertainty and risk involved in, at that point in time, he decided, well, if I'm taking care of more than, if I'm responsible for more than just myself, I had better, maybe I'll become an officer. So he went through OCS and became an officer. And then he comes home and he marries mom and they, you know, they spend one night in Ogden and She goes back home down to Cleveland, and dad goes, you know, reports back to the military to his duties. And then when it's time to report for his active duty service, he's in Memphis, and he comes to, and he gets there a week early and decides, well, I'll just report because I haven't got anything to do. I don't know anybody. So he goes, reports in. Because he reported in that day, a week early, there was a unit going through that's needed an officer. And even though he hadn't been trained and you know what they were doing, they needed an officer, so they grabbed him. Because of that, he went to Europe in a tank destroyer battalion instead of going to the Bataan Death March. And so I think there's a line in
Wow.
Doctrine and Covenants that says, let no one count these as small things, for there is much in futurity that depends on them. So we can see some of the things that we're seeing in these scriptures is this is when the church is still very, very young. And these are just people making little decisions. And we can look from, you know, almost 200 years later, and we can look back and look at the implications and the consequences of little individual decisions. And some of them we can see made a huge difference. And some of them, you know, for somebody leaving the church, that makes a huge difference to a line. For my dad, I wouldn't be here if he hadn't listened to grandma. Also, if various times during his military service he had to listen to promptings of the spirit that saved his life, don't stay here, move this Jeep right now. And they did, and that makes, you know, that little decisions like that make a huge difference. Then we can look at decisions in our own lives where there's much in futurity that depended on some little decision, you know, like career-wise for me. Shauna had an inspiration that we should, you know, go to California and start me as a technical writer, you know, to take the certificate training to get me started in a career, you know. So now I've been doing that for 41 years and I'm about ready to retire. But I can look back to that inspiration, that single moment when Shauna had this inspiration, you know, this is something that could work for us. And off we go. And then I can look back after these 41 years and think, yeah, it's a good thing that we listened to the promptings of the Spirit. And so maybe people reading their family histories, thinking about these stories, realized, yeah, these decisions, these momentary decisions, one decision at the right time in the right place can have huge implications.
That's great for histories. Mark?
I think that's with Pioneer Day coming up, at least here in Utah. That's especially appropriate. We've got, so many of our own families' individual records that we're tasked with, curating and preserving and publishing and sharing and holding sacred that. We can use all these stories of our lives and preserve these, pioneer ancestors or, whether or not it's, coming across the plains or whether it's, joining in Ireland in, 1915 or, whatever our pioneer story is, whatever brought us to the gospel, we can save these things and, help bring others to Christ and kind of emulate the way, as it were, show how we've, walked down the path, show how we've, had our own leaps and splats and done well and other times not done so well and, help others learn from our good examples and our bad. So I think, there's definitely some wisdom that was, behind this, part of the revelation to,
Yeah.
keep this straight.
Well, thank you, brothers, for sharing. For those who are listening, there are three really great journals of prophets of the church that have now been released by the Church Historian's Office: Wilford Woodruff, Heber J. Grant, and Spencer W. Kimball. And frankly, I'm surprised to see the Heber J. Grant one, along with George Q. Cannon. There are some journals that I heard about all through my adult life that were in the archives and nobody could get access. And now here they are. And you read them and after all the rumors and speculation about what was in them, it's just like the minutes for the Council of 50. It's just real life, Kevin's laughing. He's old enough to remember this. Mark's just a child, really. He still has young children in the
I guess that makes me a child. Sure, why not?
home.
I'll run with
Anyway.
that. I'll go with anyway, that story.
Go ahead. Kevin, you had a message from this group of passages in the Doctrine and Covenants that impressed you.
Well, this one in verse 6. Yea, thus saith the still small voice, which whispereth through and pierceth all things, and oftentimes it maketh my bones to quake, while it maketh manifest, saying, and it talks a bit more, but this is one of these passages where it's striking because it's describing what it's like to feel the influence of the Spirit. And one of the things Emmanuel does here that I like is it refers to four or five other places in the Doctrine and Covenants, you know, like D&C 6, and D&C 8, D&C 9, and D&C 11. And I think it's important to pay close attention to these things because, you know, what do we expect sometimes? You know, because if the only story you hear about answer to prayer is the first vision, then that may set up your expectations in one way. But then you get these other ones where it's just talking about impressions. You know, like one of the ones that the manual refers to as D&C 128, which is an epistle about baptism for the dead. And he says, I'm writing about this because it's the thing that presses itself most strongly upon my mind. And, you know, a lot of times that's the way mine have come. Even in Joseph Smith's history, when he says, never did any passage of scripture come with more power to the heart of man than this did at this time to mine. It entered with great force into every feeling of my heart, and I reflected upon it again and again. Now, I had that kind of experience when I read The Great Angel. You know, this book, you know, this is the one. And I recognize that kind of thing. And once when I was at the University of Utah taking an institute class from Robert J. Woodford, he started writing down some of these, you know, other where I'd been taught basically all my life, the one go-to scripture that we used was D&C 9. You know, about the burning in the bosom and the stupor of thought. But there's a lot more than that. And after Woodford pointed out the one in D&C 11, which is really good, and the lesson does that, it says, let's see. And now, verily, this is section 11, verse 12. And now, verily, verily, I say unto thee, put your trust in that spirit which leadeth to do good, yea, to do justly, to walk humbly, to judge righteously. And this is my spirit. Verily, verily, I say unto you, I will impart of you with my spirit, which shall enlighten your mind, and which shall fill your soul with joy. And then shall ye know, or by this shall ye know, all things whatsoever ye desire of me, which are pertaining unto things of righteousness and faith, believing in me that ye shall receive. So once you're aware, at least once when I got aware of that there was more in there than I'd been taught, then I started looking. And I've got an essay out on the web called A Model of Mormon Spiritual Experience, where I've got a list of 30 distinct ways that prayers can be answered. And they're not all feeling. In fact, they're equally divided between things that are, you know, enlightening your mind or giving you righteous judgment, or else emotional things. It can be feelings of peace, calm, or guilt. You know, that too can be something where the Spirit is saying, don't go here, don't do that. But the clearer of an idea of that we have of how the Spirit works, I think the more likely it is that we're going to recognize it when it's speaking to us, whether it's speaking as a still small voice, as an impression, as a dream, as an event, or as an incident, where sometimes God speaks to us through events that happen to us, or people, or an impression from another person, or just an unfolding, an opportunity, an instance, just to have the idea that there are many different ways that it can happen, and to be open to the possibility, and even sometimes that you're going to be left to yourself for sometimes, and you have to prepare your mind to receive it, or else, you know, to get to that moment. But it can be just that one moment. I can give, you know, at this point, I'm just about to retire after 41 years as a technical writer. But it all started, you know, I've mentioned it was Shauna's idea for us to go to California and get this thing. And then after I did the internship down there, and I did one interview that didn't work, but I learned something about computer-aided engineering. I thought, you know, that's basically building things spiritually before you build them physically. And I was doing a screening call for a job, an internship, and the guy said to me, why do you want to work for us? And just without any thought, I said, because I think computer-aided engineering is the most exciting thing going on in the valley right now. I was supposed to be a screening call, and he gave me the job. And that's that single phone call, that's 41 years of employment on this whole career, because in that specific field, that led to everything else. That's and so when I think of that line in the Doctrine and Covenants, let no one count these as small things, for there is much in futurity that depends on them. I take that very seriously.
You know, Kevin, when you talk about receiving things in the stupor of thought, in section 8, verse 2, Oliver Cowdery, the Lord tells Oliver Cowdery, I will tell you in your mind and in your heart. And
In
I know
your
I've
heart.
said this on the program before, but in my observations, particularly, I mean, I've done maybe 4,000 divorces and really bad family law situations. A lot of times when someone has been betrayed, their heart dies. Jacob talks about that in particular, you know, that when he chastises the men for their you know, for their infidelity, many hearts died pierced with deep wounds. But Kevin, my observation is that when your heart is dead, you cannot feel the spirit in the same way. So when that's happened, we have to be extra cautious because a lot of times that the having it in your mind and in your heart provides an anchor, you know, two points of solid contact. When you lose that anchor and you're just relying upon what you think is in your mind, you're going to have a hard time. You're going to have a hard time knowing what's right and navigating. And so that's why it's important for us to make sure that we do that. And if we have suffered like that, then maybe we need to do that. I know a man who's got attachment disorder because he was adopted, has a really hard time connecting with anyone. And that includes our Heavenly Father. And so, you know, he's constantly, gosh, I'm not feeling anything by the Spirit. What is this? I'm living right. I'm going to the temple. I'm doing these things. But he's having a hard time feeling in the heart. And so that's something that we need to pay extra special attention to, or maybe we can help some people in some ways by realizing that if we see them struggling.
And they're what Jesus says himself. He says, if you continue in my word, then are you my disciples indeed, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Just persisting in it, you can get through those difficult times and the hard feelings and the hard moments. If just persisting through it, then you can get to the moment when the revelation comes, when the moment comes, when that key incident happens, the key insight, the key feeling change, the key understanding, the key growth that changes everything. That takes you out of the death spiral, so to speak, and gets you, on a track where, there's a way to heal. And that's one of the blessings of the gospel. And it comes through both the mind and the heart in various ways.
Okay, Mark, you had something that really impressed you in this segment to take us up to the last portion of the program tonight.
Well, one of the things that well, let me just say real quick first that I really like that, you know, Kevin has preserved this list of, you know, how the spirit works. And I think that, you know, going back to that topic of, you know, keeping our own histories and you know, preserving our own experiences, you know, how valuable would that be for, you know, our own you know, descendants to know how we felt the spirit and how, you know, we, you know, fought to, you know these things, how, you know, we understood the spirit of God to work, you know, through us and in us. You know, that's certainly something I'd want my kids to know. I talk to them about that, you know, once in a while. I don't want to bludgeon them over the head with it, but, you know, I am careful
There's nothing
to.
wrong with that. I've got five kids.
Okay.
Bludgeon away, bludgeon away.
I've only got the two, so they would get a lot more concentrated dose if I did do that. But I do want them to know that the feelings of the spirit are real and that it is accessible to them. And it's going to be, you know, sometimes it's quiet and it's hard to get to, but it's there, you know. And I think the idea of, you know, keeping it written down is an awesome thing. So going, oh, I'm sorry. Okay, moving on. talked about, and this is interesting. I've always been interested in what this verse we've been discussing, verse 6, what it leads to, talks a little bit about this this one mighty and strong, and that's kind of a well, it's been a bludgeoning a topic to death. It's been done, but I was curious to see just who was associated in these various claims of being one mighty and strong. It's something that you hear a lot from people who have aspirations to
They're
remake the church.
fundamentalists. Yeah. That
So
was
I
a big thing for the LeBaron brothers and others, who most of our
yeah
listeners probably aren't even familiar with.
no but I did some little research, and let's see, among those who were associated or thought to be the one mighty and strong, there's James Strang, there's Samuel Easton, the Kingston brothers, Ogden Kraut, and Denver Snuffer. There's another name that maybe some folks are familiar with. Also someone named Christopher Nemelka, who has claimed to translate the sealed portion of the Book of Mormon. I know there's a lot of folks who have claimed to have been revealed that sealed portion.
I saw a copy of it in Barnes and Noble once.
Oh, did you pick it up?
Nope, I did not. I resisted the temptation.
That's probably smart. I don't know what would be in there that would be worth whatever they were asking for it. But it seems to me that I really don't want to be involved in the company of folks who are looking for one mighty and strong. I'm happy with the leadership of the church. They're not, not perfect, and they're not going to claim to be, but I'm happy with with what we've got. I'm not looking to, burn the world down and then rebuild it. I like what we got.
This section of the Doctrine and Covenants also has this famous war prophecy of Joseph Smith.
It
Now, that
does,
was
yeah.
something that Brother Barney talked about when he did his Joseph Smith methodology book that we interviewed him here on Interpreter. I think, Kevin, you and John were with me. Mark, I don't think you were with us then, but if you go back to the Interpreter. When if you go back to the Interpreter Radio portion of the website, if you go back, you can find it. But he that was something that was not only notable for us, and a lot of young people, especially, they read this and they go, "Oh, Joseph Smith predicted the Civil War." Well, right after he got this revelation, they had this big compromise, and the Civil War was put off for another 25 years or so. But it did start in South Carolina, just as Joseph predicted. And so it was, is something there that even national news at the time of the Civil War realized that Joseph Smith had written this prediction way back. And it was published openly by the Saints long before the Civil War started.
It's interesting. Yeah, and it wasn't officially part of the collection that is the Doctrine and Covenants at the time, but it was added at a later time. But it was something that, like you said, Terry, was known. Let's see, I think, who was it here? Orson Pratt had a copy of this revelation with him, and he traveled with it during his missionary work, and he would cite it frequently to people who traveled. So it was definitely something that was known and eventually embraced by the saints as it came to pass. So it's a pretty cool little section.
Yeah. So, Kevin, in 86, they talk about the Joseph Smith translation. Tell us a little about that as we wrap up here. We've got about 4 minutes left.
Well, this is just one of the things that they're working on in Kirtland. Sidney Rigdon and Joseph Smith usually working together, and they'd be going through the scriptures. And in this case, in Ohio, December 6, 1832, they're just giving a reading of the parable of the wheat and the tares and applying that to the latter days. And it, and he says, Verily, thus saith the Lord concerning unto my servants concerning the parable of the wheat and the tares. So it's directly referring to something in the scriptures and talking about its relevance. So here it is something about we need to think about the wheat and the tares growing together until they're ripe. We're going to be mixed up until the final judgment. But we ought to be thinking about ourselves. What do we want to experience in the final judgment? Do we want to be designated as wheat or tares? So what kind of fruit do we want to bring forth? Are we a weed that's just taking up space, or are we doing something that's building up Zion?
One of the things that was a major change is that in the New Testament of the King James, it has the tares being gathered first. But here in verse 7, then shall ye first gather out the wheat from among the tares. And after the gathering of the wheat, behold, and lo, the tares are bound in bundles, and the field remains to be burned. So the righteous, are gathered out first. I mean, we're left to mingle for a while.
Yeah.
But right before the end, they get gathered.
Yeah.
And then one of the principles of this lesson is to, gather where we are planted. So we no longer have this big gathering. There's some great new books out about the handcart companies. Fred Woods did one about about different ways people immigrated to the church, something that hasn't been well publicized, and we don't do that anymore. I mean, Kevin, you just got a temple in Pittsburgh just in time for you to move away.
Well, we've got a temple in Tooele, so.
Yeah. You could probably throw a rock and hit it in Tooele.
I can see it. Yeah.
That's great. That's great. But that they're making the temple more accessible to Latter-day Saints all around the world, and will continue to do so. And that's a great work. But once again, it's part of the gathering. And so we gather. Jeff Bradshaw has done a great article called Stand Ye in Holy Places and What It Means. And you can find it on the Interpreter Journal website. It's in one of the Matt Brown Temple books from one of those seminars that they've collected, but you can also find it on the journal website as well. Yeah. So anyway, well, that takes care of our come follow me for this week, brothers. And we'll take a quick break and then come back and do the second part of our broadcast. But we want to thank you for listening to this podcast. This is Terry Hutchinson signing off for Kevin Christensen and for Mark Johnson. Thank you for listening.